Welcome back to the Mojo Podcast, a place for curious minds to fill up on leadership inspiration and hear wonderful stories of mojo, lost and found, high and low. I'm your host, Richard Stokes, and we meet here every fortnight to spend time with a diverse and brilliant group of guests who've been generous to spend time with me. Episode 1 of the new series came out last week, and wow, what a response. We actually had the single biggest download day for 2 years on the podcast. Now, numbers aren't why we're here, but we must be doing something right, so thank you for choosing to spend time with the Mojo Podcast. This new series, the sixth, is all about commitment, a concept we all understand that can prove elusive and even fearful for us at times. In this series, I wanted to get under the skin of commitment. How we can commit to ourselves, to our values, our purpose, and the payoff we get from commitment when we literally choose not to have any more choice. And there can be no greater statement of commitment than putting yourself into a known perilous situation, into a place known as the death zone, because you have the inner drive to be there and to thrive there. This week, I talked to an extraordinary woman, Adri Brownlee, mountaineer and adventure athlete. She's 22 and has already summited 13 of the world's peaks, over 8,000 meters. Indeed, she has just one more to go. This remarkable endeavor would make her the youngest woman to ever climb the world's 14 8,000 meter peaks and the first British woman to ever do so. And this place where she's committed to be is called the death zone for good reason.
There's not enough oxygen going to your brain, to your heart, to your muscles. So you start hallucinating, your sort of heart rate, everything goes down, and your muscles start to disintegrate because there's not enough energy and oxygen going to them. So you don't want to be up there for, say, more than 24 hours because your body will just shut down.
We talk about how she began climbing with her father at the tender age of 8, became a record holder the following year, and has been crafting a mountaineer's mindset her whole life. Adri really is commitment personified, and I want to get into this episode as quickly as possible. Just to say, my only ask of you, once you've digested this amazing story, is to do 3 things. Please leave a 5-star rating on Apple Podcast. Please write a short review on Apple and Spotify. And please do share this fantastic story with your network. I think more people need to hear Adri's story and feel the inspiration it brings. And you can help with that. So thank you. Okay, let's climb into my Mojo conversation with Adri Brownlee. So welcome back to the Mojo Podcast, and really special episode today. We're crossing over to Kathmandu in Nepal to talk to Adri Brownlee. Adri, how are you?
I'm great, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thank you. And I'd awesome. Say nice to see you, but we've had to close down our video because the Wi-Fi in Kathmandu right now is a little bit shaky.
Typical things.
But I can hear you really well. And look, Adri, I always start here. How is your mojo today out of 10?
I'll probably give myself a high 8, I think.
Okay, a high 8. So what's going on for you to generate that sort of number today?
So I had a few shaky days over the last 48 hours, let's say. I had a trip out in the Khumbu, near to Everest, climbing the Buche Peak, and I lost contact with them for a few days. So it was quite difficult trying to juggle worried families at home in the UK, and then also myself, who's very worried, and trying to make sure that everyone was safe and sound. But then yesterday afternoon, I finally got some contact with them, and everyone was very safe and very happy. So that was all good. And getting over that roller coaster and starting a fresh day kind of put my mojo back up there into the high numbers.
Right. Wow. So I imagine if we'd spoken yesterday, it might have been a little bit lower,
but yeah, it's rebounded. Probably
a zero. Yeah. Wow. Well, I'm guessing there's a sense of real responsibility in, you know, your teams that are out there doing these expeditions. So, and if you lose contact, that must be hard.
Yeah, it is. It's probably one of the hardest parts about this job as a guide and as a sort of manager for an expedition company.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to get into, you know, what's brought you to all of this and your experiences at high altitude and everything in a second. Before we do, just on mojo, And I know it's the word I use a lot, but what does that mean to you, that word mojo?
You know, I had to do a bit of Googling because I've heard the word so much and I know what it means to me personally, but I think it's sort of been altered and changed as time has gone by. And one of the words that stuck out was magic. But then when I think about it in my sense, I don't think it is about magic. I think it's more about getting through hard times and bumps in the road, or getting over that initial inertia that you have in life sometimes. And as soon as you get over that, you get onto the straight and you keep going, get faster and faster, and nothing can stop you. And that's what I think mojo is, when you're on that sort of one-way track to success and to where you want to go. For me, that's what it is. It's not really magic. It does take some hard work sometimes to get your mojo.
Yes, I love that. Yeah, it's not something that's given to you.
Right.
It doesn't come for nothing. I'm getting a sense of the hard work, the graft that needs to go in, and then you get the reward. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Mm. Sometimes you're lucky and you have good days, bad days as well. But for me, it's mostly about persistence, consistency, and then you get into the flow and then you get your mojo.
Yeah. And I'm getting a real sense of your values in there as well, Adri, in terms of that persistence, the consistency, the showing up every single time, which I guess in terms of what you do is pretty, pretty important.
Yeah, it is. It is.
So for people that haven't come across you yet, obviously I've done an intro to you, but what would be useful for people listening to you for the first time here? What would be useful for them to know about you?
Well, I like to call myself a mountaineer and adventure athlete. That kind of, it summarizes what I do at the moment. And I've done 13 of the 8,000 meter peaks. I'm 23 years old from the UK, and I've also got an expedition and trekking company, which I own with my partner, Gail G. Sherpa, who's also my climbing partner and my boyfriend. So very lucky to call him that. But that is my life at the moment. I also do a bit of paragliding here and there. But basically just trying to enjoy life and trying to make some money at the same time, as many people are doing. That's essentially it.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So let's try and unpack a bit of that. So I get that real, the real humanity bit of enjoying life, trying to make some money, which we all recognize. And your choice has been to do this at massively high altitude. So maybe should we talk about the challenge that you're on at the moment, and then we'll go backwards after that. So you've climbed 13 of the world's highest, the peaks over 8,000 meters. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah.
And this is, we'll all have heard of Everest, maybe even the likes of K2, but there's a bunch of other peaks that are also extremely high.
Yeah. So there's 8 in Nepal, 5 in Pakistan, and the rest are in Tibet in China. Okay. So they're kind of spaced out along the Himalayan range in those three different countries. And I've only got one left in Tibet, Shisha Pangma. So I've summited all the 8,000 meter peaks in Nepal and Pakistan. But yeah, it's a cool challenge, and something that was less well known probably 2 or 3 years ago. But I think a lot of people know about this challenge now because of the Netflix documentaries and all. And so it's always been my dream to climb high mountains, especially Everest, since I was a very young kid. And it was just a bit of luck and being in the right place at the right time that got me to trying this challenge to summit all the 14 8,000 meter peaks.
So maybe let's start at the beginning then, because I was going to ask why, this challenge, but I think it might be better to start right at the beginning. To get into, what ignited this passion in you? Obviously at a young age, because you're 23 now. So I would say that's still very, very young, obviously from my position. So when did this all start for you?
It all started when I was about 8 years old. And my father, he just climbed Aconcagua, which is the highest mountain in South America. And he got home and I remember just seeing him walk through the door and thinking, my father is like Superman. He is the most incredible person that I know. And I'd run back into primary school and tell all my friends, like, oh, my father's just climbed this mountain. It's called Aconcagua. And, you know, they're just looking at me like sheep, just totally like deer in headlights. What are you talking about? Totally confused. And, you know, I always had this inkling inside that, you know, I was a bit different from my friends in that regard, that I loved the mountains and I loved the nature and climbing and all these big achievements. And so a year or so later, our teacher, our primary school teacher, asked us to write down on a sheet of paper for homework what we want to do when we're older. And so I wrote down on that paper that I want to climb Everest and I want to inspire other people to do the same thing. Not necessarily climb Everest, but do their own Everest, the cliche quotation there. But yeah, so that's what I wrote down when I was 9 years old. And that was it. That was stuck in my mind. And I knew that I was going to persevere with this goal and make it happen no matter what. And I knew that I also had my father by my side and also my mother as well to help me reach this goal.
Wow. And, you know, that's quite some manifestation, because here you are obviously a few years later doing exactly that. And having that, I don't know, that sort of presence of thought at that sort of age does strike me. And you said it yourself, I felt quite different to my friends. That does feel quite different, probably to most children at that point. What do you put that down to? Is that, you know, is that nature or nurture or a bit of both in terms of how you were brought up?
I think it's mostly nurture. I think it's my parents, especially my father. He would take me out every weekend to go and train in the Surrey Hills or in Richmond Park, put on a little backpack or bring a tire and wear a harness and pull the tire up the hills. This was my childhood growing up. I was training with him. There were some days that, you know, I would not want to get out of bed. That's the last thing I wanted to do. I just wanted, you know, play with my toys. But there were some days where actually, you know, I had the best time and I really appreciated it. And it got me to trying out bigger and better challenges, like the Three Peaks challenge when I was 9 years old. And that was also kind of the turning point in my life where I had to make some pretty tough decisions on that challenge.
So the Three Peaks, for people who don't know, this is the three highest mountains in the British Isles, right?
Yep. So it's the highest mountain in England, Scotland, and Wales. And you got to do it in under 24 hours. It's kind of the main mission.
Right. So it's a time limited thing to climb up the three. So there's Snowdon, Scarfell Pike, and Ben Nevis. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And so what was important about that experience for you?
My father and I set off for this challenge, we started on Snowdon, the lowest of all the peaks, and technically probably the easiest as well. We smashed that out of the park. That was fine. We got back down from Snowdon, got in the car, raced to the next mountain, Scaffold Pike, also climbed that. A friend of my father's joined us for that. Brought some incredible flapjacks. So I'll never forget that moment. And that gave me energy to then summit Scaffold Pike. And so we did that. And I was, you know, pretty tired at this point. We'd just done two peaks in maybe 15 hours. And then we got back in the car and drove all the way to Scotland. And before even starting the last peak, it all started pretty dreadfully. So I got out of the car, I had everything on and ready to go. It was quite miserable weather. It was pretty chilly as well. So I had sort of thermals on. I had like salopettes, waterproof trousers, everything. Probably about three layers on my legs. And then I realized I had to go to the loo to pee. Normal thing. But the problem was that I was so desperate, I just didn't have time to get everything off, and managed to pee all over all of my clothes. Didn't have a spare part as well. So ended up wearing soggy clothing on Ben Nevis. But anyway, we trooped on, powered up, and we got about 100 meters away from the summit. And then everything sort of changed. And I was shivering uncontrollably. I was so cold, but at the same time, I was 9 years old. I didn't really understand what was happening. So I was trying to keep going. I could almost see the summit. And at this point, there were other people climbing on the mountain as well. And people were stopping us and putting on layers upon layers upon layers on me to try and get me to warm up. But it wasn't working. And then my father, he brought a thermometer with him because I'd been sick the week before. So he brought it just in case. And he took my temperature and I was 34 degrees. So I was borderline hypothermic.
Right.
And he didn't want to freak me out. So instead, what he did was he turned me around. And he looked at me, he said, look, Andrew, you've got two choices right now. And this is very important. He said, either you can go for that summit, it's 100 meters away. And if you complete this Three Peaks challenge, you'll be the youngest person ever to do it. Or you can turn around and go back home, probably go to the hospital and get to safety and essentially quit and give up on this challenge. And I didn't even have to think. You know, I remember tears were strolling down my eyes at this point because I knew the answer. And I told my dad, okay, that's it. We have to get back down. And so it took us about an hour to get back down to the car. And the whole way I was just, you know, crying my eyes out. And the thing I was most worried about was telling my mom that I'd failed. I don't know why it stuck with me so much. And when we got to the car, probably an hour into the drive back home, I told my dad, you know what, we're going to have to try this again. You know, I'm not going to give up that easily. You know, I was committed to making this happen and to achieving this goal. And so 2 months later, we went back and we started with Ben Nevis instead, did it the other way around, and we completed the challenge in 21 hours. So I did become the youngest ever to do the Three Peaks at that time. And I got into the local newspaper and I knew two things. I knew, number one, that this is exactly what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. I love the mountains. But also number two, that I had the mountaineer's mindset. And I think my father also realized that, okay, she's going to be safe on the mountains and I'm not going to make silly decisions, which is something that catches a lot of people off guard, especially on the higher peaks. So yeah, this was a big, big challenge for me and a big life lesson.
Yeah, wow. And you know, you've told me this twice now, the story, and each time I expect you to say to your dad's choice, oh yeah, I went for the summit. And of course, because it seems like, well, obviously that's what I'm going to say, but as you said, at that tender age, and here's your dad giving you the choice, you had the mindset to say, no, I need to turn around because I'm not ready. This isn't going to end well. And I think that's just astonishing. To have that presence of mind at any point, but at that age, especially. And then to go again and to complete it. And, you know, as you said, with 3 hours to spare by the sounds of it. So yeah, what a moment. It sounds like that, you know, and the way you tell that story, it's so evocative, but it sounds like that was a real moment in time for you, a real key point.
Yeah, definitely. That's something that I carry with me to this day. And yeah, it gives you motivation as well, to know that sometimes the summit isn't always the most important thing, but your safety and your health is always number one. It's been incredibly important for me to keep that thought with me in the death zone at 8,000 meters.
Well, and that, you know, that's where I'd like to, you know, metaphorically spend a bit of time, you know, in the death zone. And this is the area, is it around or above 8,000 meters where this term comes in?
Yeah, so it's any area above 8,000 meters where essentially no life can live. It's inhospitable environment. So it's incredibly dangerous up there, and you are dying, literally dying every moment that goes by. So you're trying to get in and out of that area as quickly as possible, essentially.
Yeah, this literal dying is because the human body wasn't designed to exist at this sort of altitude.
Yeah.
Right.
There's not enough oxygen going to your brain, to your heart, to your muscles. So you start hallucinating, your sort of heart rate, everything goes down, and your muscles start to disintegrate because there's not enough energy and oxygen going to them. So you don't want to be up there for, say, more than 24 hours because your body will just shut down.
Right. And this is where, as we said right at the beginning, this is where you've chosen to spend quite a lot of your time.
Yeah, exactly. After the Three Peaks, I decided to try and do the Seven Summits with my dad. I was around 14 at this time, I think, because I had to juggle school and all my extracurriculars. So I didn't have a lot of time to climb, but I knew that I wanted to continue. So from the age of about 15 to 18, we did Aconcagua, Elbrus, and Kilimanjaro. And then the next peak was supposed to be Everest. But then when I was 18, 19, that's when COVID started. And then that's when sort of Everest got postponed and cancelled and then postponed again and then cancelled again. And I was losing all hope of ever climbing Everest. That's actually when I contacted my mentor for 2 years, who was Nims Dai, who's famous for doing record 14 8,000 meter peaks. So I messaged him. I was like, "Are you doing Everest anytime during COVID? Are you doing anything?" Because I was just, at this point, I was borderline depressed because I spent so much time and effort and everything in my life to try and get to this 8,000 meter peak, to try and do Everest, and it just I couldn't see the light at the end of the tunnel at this point. I've been training 3 hours a day, every single day of the week. So much time and effort, and as well trying to get the sponsorship raised. And then it was just all kind of just blocked. There was a wall there. So that's why I contacted him, and he said, "Yes, we're gonna try and do it in October. So you're more than welcome to join." And I was supposed to do it with my father. So that was the whole project, was father daughter. But the price to climb with him was double the price that we were originally going to go with. So my dad said, "You know what? This is your project. This is your life goal. You go and smash this out of the park. And I trust you to, go on your own." And so I signed up for that, and that also got cancelled. But then I actually met Nims in person after that, and he said, "So our team is going to go to K2 Winter, in Pakistan." And I just said, "Okay, wonderful. Good luck. Have an amazing time. Sounds like an incredible feat and achievement if you guys make it." And he said, No, you can come with us." I was like, "What?" This is not a normal conversation that you have day to day, to be invited to probably the hardest mountaineering feat that's ever been done. And he said, "Yeah, just come to this expedition and meet the gang, meet the group. All the Sherpas and do some training there before you go for Everest." So I said, "You know what?" I didn't even have to think about it. I was like, "Yeah, I'm down. I'm 100% going to do this." And so 2 months later, I was in Pakistan with a group of nine Sherpas and Nims Dai and another cameraman from Bristol, and we had the time of our lives. It was the most incredible experience, and I got to go to Camp One on K2 in the winter, which is also just mind-blowing, in this sort of minus 30, minus 35 degrees, really diving into the deep end. But that's where I also, Nims Dai gave me the idea to go for the 14 8,000 meter peaks.
I see.
He told me, "Adri, you're made to do this and you have to try." And he said, "Do it over like 5, 6 years, take your time." I was like, "No, I want to do it over 2 years. I want to get it done and dusted." And so I also met my partner, Gelji Sherpa, on K2 Winter. He was the youngest of all of them to summit K2. And he took me to Camp One, actually. He was my partner. And then I said, "You know what? I never ever want to climb with anyone else in my life again. Gelji Sherpa is the one for me." So took all of that from K2 Winter and went on my merry way to trying to complete the 14 8,000ers.
Wow. So this is kind of where it kind of, as you say, the idea came from. But I'm getting, yes, there's idea, but there's also, I'm getting this real sense of belief. And not obviously not just your own belief, but from someone else like Nims, who, I've seen the Netflix documentary and I do follow him on Instagram, and some of his undertakings are just quite incredible. And to have that, I guess that, as you say, that mentor in your corner sounds like it made a real difference. And here you meet your partner as well, your climbing partner and your life partner. So quite an important expedition, that one then.
Oh, definitely. Probably the best moment of my life, actually, that expedition. It was a lot of fun, and just to be with such incredible mountaineers was so life-changing. And it didn't scare me, it didn't put me off. Actually, there was quite a few deaths on the mountain, which was really tough to go through, as a 19-year-old. and that's my first experience on the high mountains. But it didn't put me off, you know. It ignited a fire inside of me. I was like, this is where I want to be. And actually, I quit university during that expedition via sat phone. So I really cemented everything on in Pakistan at that base camp.
Yeah. Okay. So I wanted to sort of touch on that a bit, actually. So there's real, I'm getting this real clarity that came from at that point. And also there's sacrifices being made around quitting university. And I'm sure we'll talk about some of the sacrifices you made along this way. Cause I think when commitment is made, there are going to be choices and things have to be sort of, you know, literally sacrificed or decide not to. Plus, you're encountering, as you say, the death on the mountain, which is a fact of life, right, up here. And, you know, the little I know about K2, it's the hardest of the mountains. Or one of the hardest, at least?
Yeah, one of the harder ones, slightly more technical than some of the others, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So talk a little bit about some of those choices then and sacrifices that you've made along the way to spend your life in the death zone.
Yeah, it all started when I went back to sort of 15 years old, and I did those three peaks within the Seven Summits group, Elbrus, Kilian, Aconcagua. And actually, just during those, I did my GCSE maths studying and revision at 5,000 meters on Kilimanjaro, because that's the only time that I could climb it. And then I missed my school prom when I was 16, which again is quite big when you're a 16-year-old girl.
Yeah, matters, right?
Then,
yeah.
And then it wasn't really a sacrifice, but I had my 18th birthday on the summit of Aconcagua. So I didn't get the big 18th birthday party, but I did get to spend it in one of the most beautiful places on earth.
Right.
So definitely no regrets there. But there was a lot of things, a lot of sacrifices that I had to go through to try and get to Everest. A lot of sacrifices within the school, mostly at that age. And also with my friends, because they didn't really understand what I was doing. And I was missing a lot of the key events in an adolescent person's life. So I did lose quite a lot of friends in that process. And then actually starting university, I went to University of Bath and then going to K2, and it just all clicked. It all fell right into place. And I was like, I do not want to study this degree. I want to make my life work on the mountains. And my parents, you know, when I called them up to tell them I'd quit, they were quite shocked. They did not expect those words to come out of my mouth. It was supposed to be just climb Everest and go back to university. But at the same time, they understood. And they were extremely supportive of my decision. And they said, you know what, if you work hard and make this happen, and you can make a career out of this, then absolutely go for it. And I'm so glad that they were supportive, because the life skills, the lessons, the people that I've met and been through on the mountains is probably a million times more than I would have got through my sports and exercise science degree at Bath. So really it was a blessing that they supported me as well with that sacrifice of my degree, because otherwise I wouldn't be here today. I'd be just graduating and probably just looking around for a job.
Yeah. And, you know, I go back to what you said right at the beginning, you felt you were a bit different to, you know, even friends at school when you were, you know, eight or nine. And, you know, that's, I'm sure, carried on. And I think that there's the courage there to plow your own path. This is the way I want to go.
Yeah.
And you know, we're talking about commitment, and often with commitment, quitting things is commitment. You've got to, you know, almost get rid of a few things around you to really commit to your true path that you know you've known for a long time. This is the way you want to go. Yet it still takes courage, I think, to divert from maybe in the norm, even conformity, which, you know, for most of us, sort of, as you said, do the university thing, get a job. That's what most people do. But you've chosen a different path.
Oh, exactly, definitely. And this is like one of the key topics that I do at school talks, for example. I don't tell the kids to not go to university, obviously, but I do tell them that if they have a passion or a dream or, you know, something that they really want to work towards, then just give it absolutely everything. And it's going to be achievable. You know, nothing is really that impossible in life. And if you really want something, then work towards it. And if it's something that maybe you want to make a career out of, then just work hard and be persistent. And then you'll get there someday. And, you know, I get a lot of backlash sometimes when people say, oh, you know, you come from a good family, you have support system, you have something to fall back on. But, you know, my parents didn't support me on my 8,000 meter peaks. You know, I had to make the money from sponsorship. I had to grind writing 200 emails a day to just try and get some sponsorship money to climb these mountains. And then I started the business because I knew that it would be profitable and I knew that I'd still be doing exactly what I love. So it doesn't matter where you come from, who you are, but if you have a passion or goal, it can be so powerful, so, so powerful. So you can just, you know, take the leap and go for it in life.
Yeah, I love that. And I've got this from a few people I've spoken to on this series already. It says when you've got that sort of burning passion, it's, you know, you can't do anything but that thing.
Right.
It's so clear. And, you know, anything that's in your way, and you talked about blockages earlier, you have to almost expect them, I guess, to show up, whether it be, you know, the money thing, which you just talked about there. You know, it's costly to climb these peaks. And you go, okay, well, I'm going to find a way then. I'm going to get the sponsorship. I'm going to create the business. And that strikes me, if there's real, you know, that in there is what commitment is about, you know, that absolute clarity and certainty of this is what I'm going to do. And with that, Adrie, tell me, has there ever been a moment or a time of deeper self-doubt or introspection of going, I'm just not sure this is worth it or what I want to do? And you talked about you've been around fatalities on the mountain and that sort of thing. Has that time ever, you know, shown itself to you?
Yeah, it has. It definitely has. But more to do with, I've never wanted to give up. Never like on an 8,000 meter peak or any of these mountains, I've never wanted to give up when I'm actually there. But one thing that I did really sort of change my opinion on was the 14 Peaks project itself, and the whole idea of the record behind it. So to actually get my sponsors, I had to say that I was going to be the youngest woman or the first British woman or the youngest person ever to summit all 14 8,000 meter peaks. And actually this was quite a huge motivator for me at the beginning, maybe for the first year and a half. And it ended up turning into something quite toxic, trying to compete with other people. But also it took away from the whole reason that I started mountaineering. And it just became this race to try and climb as many 8,000 meter peaks as possible in as short time as possible. At one time I did 4 8,000 meter peaks in 28 days, which is just like 3 years ago, no one would have done that before. It was just unheard of, but now it's become this new fashion, this new trend to try and just get as many done and as many ticked essentially in as short as time. And actually more recently, so maybe after my K2 ascent in summer last year, I realized that this is not what I want to be doing. You know, I wanted to climb 8,000 meter peaks because I love doing it. I enjoy it. And I want to climb without oxygen and I want to take my time. And I was doing the exact opposite. I was taking helicopters from base camp to base camp, you know, just sparing not even one day between each climb. And I don't even remember half of my climbs. You know, I remember the summit, but the climb itself, some parts I find really hard to remember because it's all just kind of mushed in together into one. And so after that K2, I these doubts came in and really I started questioning, do I really want to complete this 14 Peaks project? You know, is it really worth that much? And in China and Tibet recently, there was an incident on Shisha Pangma where 4 people passed away for this exact reason. They went for this record and they chose, you know, the complete wrong way to go on the summit. And this caused 2 different avalanches to happen. And the conditions just weren't right on the mountain. But because they were under pressure to get this record, they went for it. And this was kind of the camel that the straw that broke the camel's back, essentially. And at that point, I really did think, okay, I never want to finish this project because this is what's happening on the mountains at the moment. I'm still kind of toying with that because I still have this last peak to go, Shisha Pangma. And there's one side of my head that's thinking, if you complete this project, it's going to be brilliant for your business because I'm going to get recognition worldwide for finishing the 14 peaks. But at the same time, I'm thinking, you know, is it really worth it? Is it worth the risk anymore? Is it going to be the same thing on the mountain? Is it going to be people record chasing? So this is the only time where I've ever thought, is it really worth finishing this project? But when I'm actually on the mountains, I've never had doubt, because as soon as you think negatively, it just all spirals out of control. And that's when bad things happen. Almost manifest it in a sense. So you just have to think positive and keep your head down, keep going. But yeah, that's the long-winded answer.
No. Well, and thank you for, you know, for that self-reflection and kind of going there. And the honesty of exactly what you said in terms of, you know, I guess when you set out on this sort of challenge, it has its own inertia in a way. It keeps you going. And to sort of say, hang on, is this actually, as you said, is this why I started this? Is this what I want to do? And I wanted to sort of ask you a little bit around where we've been talking, actually, in terms of being in the mountains and what they mean to you. Do you have a sense of a spirituality? You know, I mean, but being that close to where you are and the sort of the top of the world and what it means.
In a sense of spirituality, the mountains sort of, they make you realize how small and insignificant you are as humans. Because these mountains are in control of everything, you know, you have no control over them. Things like avalanches, weather, crevasses, all of these things are all in the mountain's power. And so spiritually it humbles you so much, because you are in the hands of this beast essentially, and you have to make sure that you train as hard as possible, that you learn as many skills, that essentially you bow down to this mountain and give everything that you have to respect it and make sure that you can be accepted by it, and you're allowed to go there, kind of thing. So for me, that's how I feel about the mountains in a spiritual sense. And then I get drawn back to them because, well, firstly, I enjoy the stress, and I mean, it sounds strange, but I enjoy the difficulty of climbing itself, and how much effort you have to put in to actually get to the summit. You know, you really do earn it, and that's something quite special that not many people actually live through. You know, we love to live in our comfort zone. And if you're out of your comfort zone, that's when you're progressing, that's when you're learning. And this is what I love about the mountains. It really pushes you out of your comfort zone pretty much like 90% of the time. So it's really special to be out there. And when you get a taste of this in life, you can't go back. You can't go back to normality. You go insane. So you're always drawn back to the mountains, and that's why I love climbing.
Beautiful. And yeah, I wanted to sort of move us towards what's next and the future for you. So, you know, there is the 14th peak to climb. I mean, you did talk about, you know, some of the reservations about it, but have you got a plan in terms of completing the 14th?
So, well, the upcoming date for the expedition is in April, so spring this year. And again, I'm just, you know, I'm waiting for that moment when I feel that the mountain is calling me, and I'm not waiting, you know, I'm not the one wanting to go there to finish my project. It's almost like a spiritual thing. I need it to call my attention, and I need it to call me and my name. And then I know that I'll be ready to go. And I'm not going to know that probably until the week before I'm supposed to depart, knowing me. And then it'll be a mad chase to try and get all my things packed and ready. But yeah, I'm gonna leave it really last minute this time so I can have a deep think about it. I also can't climb with my partner Gelje, which is another huge thing for me that's really drawing me back, because he's guiding on Everest our company, which is amazing. I mean, I'm so excited about that. But at the same time, like, you know, I want to be in Kathmandu, and I want to be on Everest to witness this, to see our company growing. And also the selfish side of me is saying, you know, you don't want to climb without Gelje on the mountain, on Shisha Pangma. So yeah. And then, I mean, to top it all off, it's quite difficult with Shisha Pangma because there's been rumors going around that this is the last time it's ever going to open again. So it could be the last chance I ever get to completing the 14. So there's a lot of different things going around in my mind, and the honest answer is I will not know if I'm going to go until the last minute.
Wow. So a lot of, I'm getting the sense of a lot of competing forces
Yeah, a lot.
that are going on there.
I've got the angel and devil.
Well, on both shoulders, exactly. And is there anything that you do? I love to get a sense of, almost daily practices from my guests, because I get a lot of, people do talk about the things that you do that help literally with their mojo and to commit to things. Do you have practices that are, for you, are like, this is what I need to do, or this is how I need to be every day to allow, the call to come from the mountain?
For me, it's just about being consistent with my training. That's a very big thing for me, because one of the things you can control is your fitness. So if I know I'm physically ready, that's kind of one tick, and that's one stepping stone towards getting to that summit. So I have to train every morning. I have to feel good about myself, and then just sort of, picturing the mountain, going, learning things online, going through skills at home, watching videos about the climb, the route, learning a bit about the history. All of these things keep me going and keep me excited for that project. And then also I'm working in the mountaineering industry anyway, so I'm always there, I'm always present. I'm always thinking about Shishapangma. So for me, it's just about having that routine in the morning in terms of my training, and then just touching on little things every day to keep the excitement and the spark alive.
And what sort of things are those?
Just watching videos or even thinking about past climbs that I've done, or just remembering how amazing it feels to be on that summit, or watching other people on Shishapangma summit. Just these kind of things, what draw me to the mountain as well, and what get me mentally ready. Because that's the other side of it. It's physically ready and mentally ready. So that's what I do. And I just wait for those last few days before I need to pack up and leave to the mountain. And that's when I'll make my decision.
Amazing. Well, whatever decision you make, we wish you well. We wish you all the best with that. And as you say, you're doing
Thank you.
what I'm getting the sense of, control the controllables, control your physical
Exactly. Yeah.
position, your mental position, your energy. You're doing all of those things. So we'll keep an eye out for progress and news on that. And Adri, tell me as we sort of close up, what's the best way for people to keep in touch, actually, to find out what you're doing, what you're taking on? Obviously now we're maybe completing the 14, but also what's going to come in the future.
Horrible with social media, but the best one is Instagram. So it's adri.brownlee, and that's where I update everything. And then you can also see through Girl J's Instagram as well, and our company Instagram. So there's
Brilliant.
many different ways to watch the progress, but my Instagram is probably the main one.
Great. Well, I'll put links to all three of those accounts into the show notes so people
Awesome.
can follow. And the other thing to say is obviously a big thank you to the Athlete Media Group, who I know represent you and have put us in touch to record this. So if you're a corporate business or a school or whatever, and you'd like Adri to come in and talk in this incredible motivating way, then you can get in touch with them, and then the link to that will be in there as well. And Adri, just to close, and we're talking about the future. Do you have this sense of, and maybe you'll do the 14. What's next after that? And I know you're creating this lovely life and the business out in Kathmandu. Is there a sense of where this goes?
I think making the business successful, that's kind of my baby at the moment. Just nurturing that and helping it grow. And then Gazi and I decided to do one big peak per year, with our savings, that we want to achieve. Maybe it's an unclimbed peak or alpine style, something like this. And then also just trying out new hobbies as well. There's so many things to try in the world, not enough time. So just dipping our feet into different areas.
Amazing, amazing. And having your climbing partner and life partner by your side sounds like an amazing way to do that.
Oh yeah, very lucky.
Well, look, Adri, this has been, honestly, an amazing conversation for me. I know people are going to love listening to your story. So I really thank you for joining the Mojo podcast today.
Well, thank you so much, Richard.
I told you it was a special story. It's a shame we couldn't do video on this one, as my face gets pretty expressive with each moment of daring do that Adri explains. I mean, so much to take away from this one, to think about and then even integrate into your own life. I think her story can resonate with anyone, whether you're her age or, like me, probably closer in age to her dad, but it's all so relevant. Just a few notes from me. I love how she talks about and acknowledges the mentors and the allies that she's had around her. Clearly her father, her parents, for all the support that they've given. And then people like Nims Dai, one of the most famous mountaineers in the world. And of course, her partner in climbing, her partner in life, Gelgi Sherpa. These are the people that she's obviously recognized that she's needed to have around her at various different points. And that is really smart to build that kind of supportive network. Then there's her values and purpose that come through in everything that she talks about, from kind of what she thinks mojo is, you know, this idea of real persistence and consistency that led her to almost rethink the whole idea of chasing records, of conquering this 14th peak. So real principles in action there at, you know, it has to be acknowledged, a very young age. And then she talks about the idea of what you can control and pushing comfort zone. I love this as well, just being really clear on where she is and what she can control, you know, her physical and mental capabilities. But then the mountain will have another point of view on control. And this sense that comfort zone, yeah, if we live within it, we don't really grow. So she is constantly pushing. You know, she said 90% of her time on the mountain is beyond her comfort zone, which says a lot. You'll find lots more about her and the people she's mentioned in the show notes. I also want to call out, there's a link there to the Athlete Media Group, and a massive thank you to Mark at AMG for putting me in touch with Adri. And if you're a business or an organization that'd love to hear more of Adri's motivational speaking, then get in touch with the Athlete Media Group. And finally, yeah, just that holy trinity of things that you can do to support the Mojo podcast. Please rate and review or wherever you hear the podcast, and please do share with people you think will need to hear amazing stories like this, and much more to come next time on the Mojo podcast. And until then, I hope your mojo continues to flow.